Andrea Stanley joins me this week to discuss craft malting and malt varieties. This is Beersmith Podcast number 222.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 222, and it's late September 2020. Andrea Stanley joins me this week to discuss craft malting and barley varieties. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com. And also the Brew Commander, the new brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. It's available in electric and gas propane models. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a high-quality brewhouse controller that offers automated step mashing, boil timers, precision temperature control, and advanced settings. Command your brew day with the new Brew Commander. To order yours today, visit BlickmanEngineering.com for more information. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, I urge you to give Beersmith 3 Brewing Software a try. If you've not downloaded the new 3.1 update, grab it now from the main download page. It includes improved data storage, additional dry hop options, new mash pH models, and a whole lot more. To download your free 21-day trial today, go to beersmith.com. Again, that's beersmith.com. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome back Andrea Stanley, co-owner and founder at Valley Malt. Valley Malt is a small craft malt house in New England. You can find more about their malt house at valleymalt.com. Andrea, it's great to have you back on. How are you doing?
Doing good, Brad.
You've been pretty busy, I understand, right?
Yeah, I have been busy with COVID hitting. We just have a lot more work to do at the malt house, and kids at home, three kids that are now in high school, middle school, and elementary school. So three different schedules and everybody getting used to online learning and that kind of thing. So yeah.
And aren't those teenage years great too, right?
Oh my God, I'm loving it.
Anyways, but I mean, you guys do everything. You grow, right? You grow malt there, you malt it right on site, right?
We do, although we don't really grow a significant amount of grain anymore.
Okay.
This year, probably less than 5 acres.
Okay.
And yeah, we probably malt the equivalent of 500 acres. So just a small portion that we still grow ourselves just because of prioritizing what we need to do. So that kind of wasn't really a... growing grains on a small scale like we were trying to do just didn't really make a lot of sense.
Not commercially sensible, perhaps?
Yeah. And so we've been hanging on to just kind of doing it to keep some certain varieties, you know, keeping seed for it and that sort of thing. But
So where do you get most of your malt then? I should say most of your raw barley, right?
Yes, barley, warthog wheat, danko rye, those, and organic corn. Those are kind of our three primary grains that we source. And this year has been really great in that we've been able to source. It's been a couple years now where the pace is picking up in terms of getting grain from places other than just New York. So for a long time, New York was kind of where we were sourcing most of our grain, just because the farmers there already were grain growers. They were already growing wheat and could transition pretty easily to, you know, getting us really beautiful quality barley. And then, like, more recently, we've had a few farmers, a dairy farmer in New Hampshire that's been slowly creeping up to growing 30 to 50 acres. There's a guy in Vermont that's growing, you know, I can't remember how many acres, but I think, you know, he for us can grow about 30. There's
and you're in Massachusetts. You're kind of in between all these places, right?
Exactly.
Western Massachusetts, right?
Yep. So, you know, New Hampshire is only, you know, where this farm is, you know, maybe 30, 40 miles. Same thing with Vermont. It's, you know, maybe 50 miles. And then Spencer Thrall, who owns a malt house down in Connecticut, he grows excess grain. And so we can buy that from him. And that's only maybe 20, 30 miles. Wow. So it's been great to see that, you know, 10 years in now, we're getting to more of that hyper local. Although New York is still a really important source for us to source grain.
I'm originally from New York, upstate, and I went to school in Albany, not far from where you are. So,
yep. Yeah.
Anyways, you wanted today to start a discussion about the revitalization of some new barley varieties, and maybe we should start and first explain that, you know, it's relatively small number of barley varieties that are grown commercially at a large scale in the U.S., right?
Yeah, there's probably, well, the number keeps growing every year in terms of the varieties that are approved by the American Malting Barley Association. Mm-hmm. So there's probably 20 plus varieties on that list now, which is great. But then if you just look at like crop reports, see that the percentage is, you know, a large percentage of the malt barley grown out there is probably primarily like 2 to 3 different varieties. And I think a lot of that just has to do with there's also kind of a fairly constricted region where a lot of that's being grown. So those are good varieties adapted for that region. It kind of makes sense to have more of a monoculture in that way.
But with the craft beer revolution, and then of course the small malt houses starting to pop up again, we're seeing renewed interest in other varieties, perhaps historical varieties, I guess.
Well, the historical varieties is kind of a real nerdy project. So anybody doing historical varieties, it's definitely nerdness. It doesn't really have to do with having a good supply chain for malt. Mm-hmm. So what's happened is because there's all these craft maltsters now, like just take our region, for instance, and this is happening in other regions. But in the Northeast, we have Cornell that has this like amazing history. The Love Lab at Cornell University has been breeding cereal grains for over 100 years. And so they started refocusing a few years ago on malt barley again because of the craft malt houses. And so, yeah, this sort of evolution to more varieties being grown really has to do with a real need for certain regions that have not been, where malt barley hasn't been grown for a while or ever, they need their own like regionally adapted varieties. And so that's what you're seeing is more modern varieties being purposefully bred for these new malt barley growing regions.
Well, that was one of the next questions I had for you. Why are some of the craft maltsters interested in these new varieties, I guess?
Yeah, and it really has to do with trying to make our industry economically viable. So if we can find varieties like what's happening right now that I see happening on the ground in New York, we can find good varieties for the region and they can yield really well for farmers. Mm-hmm. Then those farmers make money. The cost of the barley is a little bit less expensive for the maltster that gets passed along down the way so that hopefully things become more affordable over time. And part of what makes things more affordable too is that you're alleviating some of the risk involved. So by having regionally, like, you know, the handful of barleys that grow really well in the Northeast, you know, they're yielding really well for the farmer. So the farmer is actually seeing more cash because of the work that's being done to, you know, make sure that we have a Northeast malt barley variety.
And so as you mentioned earlier, I mean, you're mainly a malt house. So how is the, sort of the craft malt houses playing into this? Are you trying to source more local ingredients, for example?
Well, that's all we do. So we source 100% of our grains come from the Northeast.
Okay.
So, and that's most craft maltsters I know. Most of the ones that are kind of come from the same background that Valley Malt comes from. Mm-hmm. There are some larger craft malt houses that may not be sourcing so locally. Mm. But most of us are, we're all about what is it, we're all about sort of that local circular economy when it comes to craft beer, trying to really keep it as local as possible.
And I know we talked about your malt house several years ago when I had you on, but you've expanded quite a bit since then. At that time, you just had a handful of malts. I think you're producing quite a few now, right?
Yes, I am.
She's cracking a beer open there for folks on the audio there.
Yeah, I mean, this beer that I'm pouring was a collaboration beer that has, a lot of different grains in it. Spelt, triticale, wheat, rye. I think some buckwheat. It was a grisette. That was a collaboration. We're malting, just a lot of different types of grains. Malted corn has been a great product that's been gaining popularity. And then, breaking some of those malts out into different roasted products too. We're definitely providing a lot more different malts than we were, even 5 years ago.
Well, back to growing malts. I think you were working on a particular barley named Hannah, right? Can you tell us a little bit about that and how that project came about?
Yeah. So this is more the nerdy situation I was talking about that I find myself in. So in doing research about varieties, and kind of going down the history wormhole of it, I got to learn that before there were actual varieties of barley, there was wild barley growing that people would harvest. And then that wild barley became somewhat domesticated, or at least cultivated intentionally by people. And in the Caucasus Mountain area. And then that kind of spread out to different parts of the world. And those different parts, then the cultivated barleys that they were growing were called landraces. Hmm. So they were still a mixed population, which means, all those different wild barleys had all different genetics.
So I'm not familiar with the term. What does landrace mean, I guess? Is it just
so it means that there was an area where a certain crop or animal was developed through just, human intervention. So through what you could actually call prehistoric breeding. They were intentionally harvesting the ones that were good and had the qualities that they wanted.
Cultivated, yeah.
And then saving that seed and saving the best for the seed so that after generations, you kind of develop this very unique landrace population. Mm-hmm. So it's been, somewhat tinkered with, but not to the point that nature isn't still involved in terms of survival of the fittest ones.
And so how does Hannah fit in there?
Hannah fits in that it was a Moravian, so in the current Czech Republic, in that area down by between Prague and Vienna, basically, or at least that was the two major train stations when we went there last year. But Moravia was a really, had beer culture, it had, malt barley that was did really well there. And so that was the landrace from Moravia for generations. And then in the early 1900s, there was things like expos, like the Paris World Expo, and people would bring the best of their crops to these expos to kind of show them off. Mm-hmm. And so Hannah was obtained by a USDA plant explorer at that expo, brought back to the United States and given to some of the different parts of the country to see where that particular like land race could grow around here.
And when was this? This was the 1800s or something? I don't know.
Well, no, this would have been early 1900s.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think the Paris Expo was in 1901. So then Cornell actually was, you know, doing doing research, I guess, on that. And it did become like a sort of variety that helped to
So it was grown commercially for some period of time, I guess. Yeah.
Yes, it was. It was to help supply a lot of the German brewers that were, you know, dominating around that time.
Interesting. And then it appears at some point it fell out of favor, right?
Yeah. At some point, more, you know, Mendel's law, you know, just a lot of like things about genetics and breeding were sort of learned and discovered during those early 1900s. And so eventually what happened was we got to where we are today, which is where, you know, breeders breed a certain variety. And so then every seed within that field or that variety, like if you get a bag today of Metcalf, every seed in that bag is, you know, genetically the same. It's Metcalf. It's a variety. It's a single varietal. Mm-hmm. So I think what happened was, you know, just people became more educated and agriculture also changed significantly and the goals of agriculture changed significantly to, you know, just wanting bigger yields. And
I'm thinking, I actually had Stan Hieronymus on last episode and he was talking about how they breed hops, but they're looking, you know, not only for yield, but they're also looking for disease resistance and, you know, a whole bunch of other things as well, right?
When they're breeding varieties, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's important. So. Disease resistance and, you know, especially here in the Northeast, like if it's a winter variety, the cold tolerance of it is important. Mm-hmm. But anyway, yeah. So Hannah, so, you know, we really haven't, as craft beer consumers, we love to talk about historic beers and recreate historic beers, but we're recreating them with modern raw materials, modern ingredients. So we're not really getting the full experience of what that beer would have tasted like. And so this is one way that I wanted to contribute to that was to bring back a few landrace varieties. Hannah was one of them. Mm-hmm. And just be able to brew beer with it, make whiskey with it, that sort of thing.
So, where are you now with the Hannah project? I guess you're attempting to grow it again, right?
Oh yeah. So, you know, this has been a 9-year endeavor.
Wow.
And started with 5 grams of seed and little by little grew that seed out to the point where I could harvest it with a small combine. And then now, our first commercial field of it where we are actually going to malt it. Mm-hmm. Was 3 years ago. So
oh,
for the last 3 years, we've been every year growing about 10 acres of it and making historic beers with it. And I've been I partnered with one of our distilleries that we work with and we're making whiskey together.
Very cool. And I mean, is it distinct? Is it different? When you have these beers or whiskeys, are they much different than perhaps what you might get with a typical malt?
Not if malted properly. I think it gives you probably some differences, but it still tastes, you know, if done well and brewed well, it makes a nice pilsner. And we made a cream ale with it in 2018 that became one of the winners of like an international heirloom beer competition.
Very cool.
So that was pretty cool. Yeah. The major difference with it is that it's a real challenge to malt. They tend to be very high in protein and just, you know, takes more time to germinate. It takes a higher moisture content to germinate it at. So it takes a lot more TLC than what we're used to.
And so you mentioned that, obviously the malts have changed quite a bit over the years, but the malting process is, you know, very much more mature than it was when many of these historical beers were made, right?
Malting too, sure, yeah. I mean, probably, well, yeah, definitely the use of indirect heat was probably one of the major differences in malting over time. So
yeah, even when I started brewing in the early 80s, it wasn't uncommon to get malts that were perhaps a little bit under modified, and you really don't get that anymore, you know.
Yeah. Well, some people want it too.
Yeah. So there's a Hannah project. Are there other historical malt projects going on around the country? Are other people trying to grow and revitalize of these malts? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Very nerd specific. So, there's a malt house. Yeah. So this competition that was in Nuremberg in 2018, fall of 2018. That brought together, brewers and maltsters and farmers from around the world that are all kind of doing some very similar things, trying to, there's a malt house in Finland, Sweden that are doing things with historic Nordic varieties, land races. Crisp, the malt house in the UK, is doing a few projects with the John Ine Center. So they actually have an amazing, really robust program where they're working with a research center. So that's really interesting too.
Is there a lot of research going on? You mentioned Cornell, for example. Is a lot of research going into malted barley now in terms of developing, new varieties and so on?
Yeah. I mean, for the Northeast, given as small of a market we really are compared to other crops like corn, soybeans, and stuff like that, there's Cornell is doing actual breeding, and then some of the other universities, University of Maine, University of Vermont, Penn State, they're doing pretty robust variety trials. So they're able to actually take varieties from all around the world if they want and trial to see how it will perform in Maine and Vermont and New York. In fact, this year was the final year of a 3-year grant that the Brewers Association gave to the Craft Maltsters Guild and North Dakota State University to help all of these to help fund these variety trials throughout the Northeast, because they recognize that having other parts of the country that are sort of non-traditional grain growing areas, having them build up a better craft malt supply is, going to be good for craft brewers in the long run.
Yeah, I know. I was talking to Stan Hieronymus again, but he mentioned they're starting to grow hops now in the Midwest. They're starting to grow hops again in New York. And it sounds like something very similar is going on with you, right? With maltsters, yeah.
No, I think, if you think about it, if you're a brewer and you're getting really great local hops, why wouldn't you also want really great local malt so that you could say you're making a beer, from your region? So I'm glad that the two are being equally funded and, researched, because it's a nice synergy for sure.
Now, does it take a long time to develop a new barley variety? I know we were talking about hops. It was like 15 years or something like that, because Yeah, they have to do all this testing and yields and small scale testing, large scale testing. They bombard it with diseases and all that. Does it really take just as long to do barley?
So Cornell is coming out with a new spring barley variety. Well, this year it was already being grown in like 10 to 30 acre plots. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, going to be the first of probably a series of Northeast bred varieties. And with new technology, where you can, so say you identify like 100 varieties that look really good analytically, mm-hmm. you can then take that seed and go to New Zealand, plant it there and get two seasons in one season. So that's one of the sort of innovations that, you know, has been happening. And luckily, Cornell and some of these other places have the ability to have those nurseries down in New Zealand. So 15 years, no, not anymore. I mean, Cornell's, like I said, they're coming out with their first one and it's only been about 3 years.
Wow.
Is it going to be the best right out the gate? You know, we'll see, but there will be other successive releases, I'm sure. And I think anything that they're developing is going to probably be better than what we've got right now. So I'm excited about it.
And there's a lot of interest in non-GMO products these days. I think most malts are non-GMO though, right? There's not a lot of genetic research going on.
Nope, they are. And I don't know if, you know, never say never, but nobody, it doesn't seem like there's really any major interest in developing GMO barley. So I wish that, you know, it was cheaper to get that little non-GMO label on things, because it would be, you know, it's pretty easy to say non-GMO if you're dealing with a crop that doesn't have any GMO. Yeah. But yeah, so no, you can rest assured that definitely barley, you know, most likely wheat, any cereal grain is not going to be GMO.
And I know you said you're working with a new local supply chain group. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I guess this is kind of another new innovation in brewing local, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, this is the logo. So this is the Northeast Grain Shed. The beer that I'm drinking is... I don't know why this isn't lining up, but
yeah,
anyway.
Yeah.
That's okay. Yeah. So basically, you know, after being able to sort of help start the Craft Maltsters Guild and get a national craft malt community going, I really wanted to start something more local. The last 5 years, we have really gotten to the point where the quality of the local supply chain for grains has gotten really excellent for the most part. And so what was happening is that I would go to conferences that talk about local grains, and a lot of the conversation was just about farmers needing the market to develop a little bit faster. That mm-hmm. we're kind of not, you know, for them to stay interested in things like malt barley and wheat for milling and malting, we needed to increase the acreage and probably almost double it from like 2,000 acres every year to 5,000 acres every year to get to the point where we had some scale, you know, a big enough scale. And so we decided that we wanted to bring together millers, maltsters, anybody working with grains, and also bring together the restaurants and some of the places where people consume all these products, and take that whole supply chain, even actually starting with the breeders at Cornell and some of these other universities doing research, bring everybody together from the bottom to the top of the supply chain and all, you know, everything that encompasses that, form this organization called the Northeast Grain Shed, and really start working together on how to develop a story about the Northeast and our own identity as a grain growing region, a bread and beer basket, and to hopefully then hopefully get some grant funding to be able to really start marketing it. That we feel like consumer awareness is just pretty low when it comes to understanding grains in our diet and how important they are and how important that they're part of a local agricultural system is. And see how I say that? That sounds really boring. So that's why we were like, we need to do, you know, we need to have a marketing campaign, a coordinated marketing campaign, like, you know, Got Milk or something like that, right? Where people start identifying with this wonderful initiative that we all have going. And so we felt like we've come really far, and now we really need to start bringing it to like that next level. And so that's kind of what the Grain Shed is helping to do.
Well, going back to the original thing you mentioned, is this helped with some of the actual farmers and suppliers? By consolidating perhaps the supply chain and the interest?
Yes. So first of all, on a very basic level, it brings everybody together. So if there are people that have grain that are looking to market it, there are end users that are interested. I think it's really started to, one of the things that's coming from it too, now that we have maltsters and millers as part of this group, is what are the varieties? Because one of the things that farmers are really uncertain about is what should they grow? Which variety should they grow? Their seed dealers telling them one thing, their maltsters telling them another thing, a miller tells them another thing, a distiller tells them another. And so we're trying to identify through doing just different research, what varieties are multi-purpose. So if there's a variety of wheat out there that can be, a farmer could grow 100 acres of it, a distiller is going to take half, a miller is going to take 25%, and a maltster is going to take the other 25%, and it's going to be, you know, great for all of those. So that's the kind of stuff that we're trying to do too, is like identify the things that would make a farmer stop growing these grains and make sure that we don't let that happen, because we have some really amazing engaged farmers right now and we want to keep them.
So, you know, I find that pretty interesting. Is it does like a maltster, you know, need different grains to feed a distiller versus a brewer, for example?
Not necessarily. A lot of times their needs align pretty much.
Pretty much. I don't know. Is it actually different?
Well, if you have a craft maltster that you work with and you're a distillery or a brewery, you can have conversations about what it is that you want that malt to do. If you're a distiller, you might want that malt to be really high in enzymes.
Right.
And so we would use first of all, we have certain varieties that just have a high enzyme package to begin with. Like that's their genetics. And then if that's even like higher in protein, then, you know, those are the ones that generally most distillers might be interested in.
And I assume for milling for flour, you're probably looking at something quite different, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm still on a lovely learning curve when it comes to milling. I just became a miller a little over a year ago.
Yeah, that was one of the topics I wanted to cover. So in addition to doing malting now, you're actually making flour, right? Of some kind?
We make flour for bakeries and home bakers. Yep. We do fresh stone milled flour.
Wheat, I assume, or?
Wheat, rye, spelt, corn.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And how'd you get into that? It's obviously something pretty different than malting grain for beer, for example.
It's different, and yet it's so aligned in terms of, you know, we already have these huge silos of grain. We already have a lot of the, you know, equipment for handling grain. I already know how to stitch bags like a pro. The mill came to us because we were having our field day back in 2018 here at the Malt House. Mm-hmm. And we invite brewers, and we invited a local bakery because they buy malt from us for one of their breads. They put actually like whole kernels of malt into one of their long fermented bread. And so we invited them and they came. And as we were like walking through some of our grain fields, he said, you know, would you guys be interested in putting in a mill? Mm-hmm. I would buy, you know, substantial amount of flour from you every week. And Jonathan is the baker. Jonathan and Cheryl own the Hungry Ghost in Northampton, and it is just one of the best bakeries on the East Coast. And so when somebody like that asks you if you'll become their miller, you're like, I'm going to definitely do that. So
even though you didn't have no experience in it whatsoever, right?
Well, I had no experience in malting before I did that.
There you go.
So yeah, so he said, you know, there's this guy up in Vermont. He's a great, him and his wife have a bakery, and they just built a mill, you know, this beautiful granite stone mill, out of granite from, you know, Vermont. And I keep hearing from other bakers that it's a really good mill. And so I was like, okay. So I look up their company. It's called the New American Stone Mill, and Andrew and Blair are the people that that run it. And yeah, it was not a difficult thing, really. We didn't have to, like the malt house, we had to build all of our equipment at the malt house and engineer it all ourselves. Mm-hmm. And this was literally as simple as, you know, pay us 50%, and in 12 weeks you'll come pick it up and pay us the other 50%. Nice. And you have a mill, you know?
That's great.
So it was like, okay, this seems like something that's actually relatively simple given what starting a malt house is like.
Yeah.
And, exactly. And so we weren't really, yeah, really not that intimidated. Again, we had a lot of the grain, you know, having farmers and having relationships where we already knew where to access grain, and having that grain already be local, made it also kind of a no-brainer. So yeah, so the mill business has been really fun and exciting and is doing really well too.
I think it's really cool, like, because obviously they're able to say that they're sourcing local ingredients as well, kind of like the whole brew local trend, right?
Yeah. There are a number of bakeries. I would say the majority of bakeries probably do not use local grains, but there certainly are more smaller ones that are starting up that get it. So.
Well, and I wanted to talk about Brew Local for a minute. Has obviously we've seen more craft beer places opening up and starting to look at using local ingredients. Does that really get us, you know, kind of a little bit closer to the way beers were brewed for perhaps many centuries? Are we going backwards here?
Probably, but there were definitely was trade happening where barley was being imported and exported worldwide even 100 years ago.
Oh yeah, that was one definitely.
Yeah, that was one of the fun things I kind of learned through beer history stuff, is that, you know, California was supplying England with six row barley for, you know, decades.
Well, and then at one time in England, most of a large portion of the hops came from New York, which I thought was interesting too.
But. That's so interesting. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, I'm in a certain way it is getting back to, but you know, I think what it really is that the craft beer, our community has gotten so much wider. You know, there's so many more people, you know, opening different types of breweries, and that just means that there's more distinction that certain breweries might, you know, I mean, people are actually starting breweries now that really only want to use local ingredients.
And a lot of them are serving right out of the tap house. So they've got a local, you know, a local brew house, a local clientele, a local ingredient source. I think it's really, really pretty cool, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think, it's kind of like a bell curve, you know, it's like you have certain people that are going to use craft malt, certain people that are going to not. And I think that, I guess I do, obviously, before there was like lots of transportation, everybody was using local. And if you couldn't grow some of the stuff local, you probably didn't have a beer culture.
Well, one other area you mentioned, you started using sustainable packaging, I think, right, to reduce the environmental impact. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I only sigh because my friend just sent me this Twyla Souls, who runs Grouse Malt House in Colorado, which is a gluten-free malt house. We were talking the other day, and she sent me an article just about plastics and packaging, and made me feel really good that we set a goal to have more sustainable packaging, and that we're there. But it's, yeah, I mean, a lot of these people that developed plastics and put recycling little arrows on it, like, never intended for that to ever get recycled, you know? And that's a horrible thing. Like, it's just one of those things that you're like, God, you know? So anyway, we started in 2000. We started a couple years ago, starting to think about sustainable packaging. And so we've done it. We've kind of gone, so we were using these polywoven bags, and actually we still use some of them because we have to run out of what we committed to.
Poly plastic bag, basically, right?
Yeah. And again, they might quote unquote be able to be recycled, but they don't get recycled. So it's basically a single use plastic. And that just doesn't really make me feel good about my business to use that anymore. So we talk to certain customers. Certain customers buy malt from us in super sacks. We have a program. So our super sacks are branded Valley Malt. And basically, we're able to work out with the breweries that take those super sacks that we pay for them to ship them back to us. So we'll send them the label. They can get so many in a big box and then ship that back to us. And then
so actually 100% reusable then, right?
Yeah. And it gets, you know, we might get like 10 uses out of it or something. So that's a good one. And then we also have certain customers that want it, that work with us on cloth bags. So we have these cloth, 100% cotton, basically the old school, like flour sacks. And so for customers that are, you know, we're going to be, you know, bagging up their, you know, basically at Valley Malt, like when we're done with a batch of malt, it comes out of the kiln, it gets cleaned, it gets bagged, and it pretty much ships out that day. So those bags get put, for certain customers, go into cloth bags. And then again, they use them. We provide them with a return label. They ship them back to us. We wash them and sanitize them and reuse them just for that brewery. So we have probably about 5 breweries that we do that with. With those breweries, the idea is it works because, again, they're also using that malt within a certain period of time, like that week or a week later. So there's a very quick turnaround, and you don't have to worry so much about moisture issues with cloth bags. And then for customers that aren't doing the tote bags or the cloth bags, we now have a nice, pretty durable 3-ply paper bag that we use. And those are the same bags that we use for our flour mill. So our flour mill is all paper. And then the malt house has paper, cloth, and reusable super sacks. And that's how we did it. And we did it, you know, we didn't just do it overnight. We did, like, we had customers where we did like testing with them. So it took us about a year to get to the point where we felt where everybody was like, yes, we like your paper bags. Yes, we like these cloth bags. Yes, we could do this. So it's been fun.
That's awesome.
The brewers really appreciate it too. They don't want to throw away a bunch of single-use plastic bags, you know?
Let's see. I thought we'd take a minute. We're actually coming up near the end here, but I thought you'd take a minute maybe to talk about some of the new development phases you're doing for your business. And also, I understand you got an anniversary for the business coming, I think, right?
Yeah, we're going to be, I think in about 2 weeks, we'll have our 10-year anniversary of our first commercial batch of malt.
That's
which
awesome.
Back in 2010, that would have been Conlon barley that was grown in Hadley. And it would have been malted in a 2,000-pound malt vessel that was a single, it steeped, germinated, and kilned all in there. And I think right around our 10th anniversary is also going to be our 1,500 batches that we've done in that amount of time.
Wow.
And and we're actually, we just signed a lease on a new building. So we're going to kind of be moving away over the course of the next year from where we live, which is where we have our malt house, to a new facility. And so that's been really exciting and was a long time coming, but we found like the perfect space. And yeah, and then just our flour mill is actually going into that space in the next couple of months. So
nice.
That's kind of what's going on.
Well, I was hoping to get your closing thoughts, Andrea, on anything. I guess on 10 years of malting out of your home.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
What do I think?
What did you learn?
I feel like we've been successful, and that feels good because there were a lot of times where it just felt overwhelming and, you know, lots of questioning of, you know, whether or not we were making good enough malt or we were doing the right thing. And obviously a lot of people that are listening may have experience with, like, you know, running a small business. You obviously are sometimes, you know, your family doesn't always come first because it just can't. And yeah. And so it's good to look back at where we are at least today, right? In this moment, which is all we have, and think, you know, we're at 10 years and I'm happy with the quality of the malt we're putting out. I'm happy with the relationships that we have with our suppliers, you know, the farmers and the bag companies and, you know, whatever, like all the people that we get to interact with, and we all lift each other up and we all support each other. All of our customers, it's just, you know, it feels really, it feels really successful at this, anniversary moment. That feels so good because, I kind of know the opposite end of that. So I'm really appreciating, it as a moment of feeling like, yeah, we succeeded at least for 10 years. So,
well, congratulations to you, Andrea, on your 10th anniversary, at Valley Malting. You and your husband, I think, founded it, right? And,
yep.
And I really appreciate you coming on the show today. Thank you so much for taking the time. I know you were really busy the last couple of days, and
I know.
Appreciate you coming.
Sorry for all the back and forth. Yeah, and thanks to you, Brad, because I know you had me on many, many years ago when nobody even knew who we were. Or
at the time, I think there was four or five craft malt houses in the whole country, I think, when we had you on the first time.
And your show has a really great reach of, you know, there's some wonderful people out there that listen to your show and are really passionate about beer and all the things that we're passionate about in terms of local agriculture and sustainability. And so I'm really grateful to you too for being a part of our success in a way.
And I'll mention your website here, Valley Malt, right? Valleymalt.com, I think it is, right?
Yep. So. And our flour mill, for anybody out there that's also a home baker, is Ground Up, and our website is groundupgrain.com.
Fantastic.
And we have online ordering for flour.
Well, thank you again, Andrea. Really appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Brad. I appreciate you.
And my guest today was Andrea Stanley, co-founder of Valley Malt in New England. Thank you again, Andrea. Great to have you on the show. Pleasure.
Thanks, Brad.
Well, a big thank you to Andrea Stanley for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They're offering access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com. And also the Brew Commander, the new brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. It's available in electric and gas propane models. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a high-quality brewhouse controller that offers automated step mashing, boil timers, precision temperature control, and advanced settings. Command your brew day with the new Brew Commander. To order yours today, go to BlickmanEngineering.com for more information. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, I urge you to give the new Beersmith 3.1 brewing software a try. If you'd not download the new update, grab it from the main download page at beersmith.com. It includes improved data storage, additional dry hop options, new mash pH models, new add-ons, and much more. To download your free 21-day trial, go to beersmith.com today. Again, that's beersmith.com. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.